to the Top Producer Podcast. I am Paul Niefer, your host, and today we're going to have a conversation with Eric O'Keefe, who is the editor and publisher and probably chief window washer for the Land Report. Do I have that accurate, Eric?
I am the editor, and I have a publishing partner, a publisher who's been with me since day one, Eddie Ryder.
Okay. Perfect. I want to make sure we get, we want to acknowledge whoever's the important part of the Land Report. So, but you probably are the chief window washer, aren't you?
Bottle washer. I bus tables. I do dishes, unload supplies. If it needs doing, and that's part of the dynamic of publishing today, huge superstructures of magazines that once existed with tens or hundreds of people no longer applies in the current media market. So wear a lot of hats and pedal very fast.
Okay. Well, before we talk about the Land Report, which I'm very interested in talking about, I always like to lead off with your background. So where you grew up, maybe went to college, your career before you started the Land Report, to give the audience all those details.
From a background standpoint, I grew up in the biggest city, in the biggest county, in the biggest state, in the unfrozen United States. That's Brewster County, Texas, which is butts up against the Mountain Time Zone in far west Texas. It's in the Big Bend country. Alpine, Texas is my hometown. 100 miles south of us is a 800,000 acre national park. It's all in our same county. And that gives you an idea of the scale of the agricultural operations. It's big cattle country out there, very high, very dry, very healthy, also very isolated. And so our herds are really prized. Used to be big Hereford country. And then Clady Williams was the first pioneer, started to bring in Angus cattle. And now you see still plenty of Hereford, but a lot of Angus throughout the Big Bend. I graduated in a class of 72 from Alpine High School and went to Rice University in Houston, where I studied history and politics and political science. And followed that up with a congressional fellowship on Capitol Hill, which convinced me that I didn't want to go into the political side of things. And thank goodness I didn't. I'd be caught in that mess right now called the nation's capital. And I'm happy to be many, many time zones and zip codes away from that. I got out of Rice, did that LBJ fellowship. And ultimately, I began working with a real estate advisory firm that had an appraisal division. And it was an interesting twist, Paul, because the chief partner, the lead partner of the firm, thought my appraisals, my narratives in the appraisals were worth reading. He said, normally these are sawdust and you write really well, and I'm not trying to talk you out of the firm or out of this business, but you might want to consider journalism. And I grew up, I don't know what your family was like, but we had Time Magazine, we had Newsweek, we had National Geographic, we had all of these publications. And I grew up, reading those stories and following certain journalists and authors and writers. And so I'm literally just one day called, I was in a bookstore, a B. Dalton. Do they exist anymore?
They do not.
I was in a bookstore and I saw a series of guidebooks called the Texas Monthly Guidebooks. And there was no guidebook to my section of Texas, the Big Bend country, which is where we have two national parks, all sorts of state parks. And so I literally cold called the publisher of Texas Monthly Guidebooks and told him my name, my background, my experience, and that I wanted to write the Big Bend guidebook. And he said, go for it. How do you like that for a pitch? My first assignment was a 80,000 word book, and took me several years to complete. And that began my career in journalism. I did a lot of travel writing, and from travel writing, I got hired on. This will be an interesting ag twist for your readers, your followers. I became the executive editor of Chili Pepper magazine.
Oh, wow. That probably has a large subscription base, doesn't it, Eric?
Oh my gosh, those chili heads are incredibly passionate. And that was my first real exposure to, you know, I had grown up in cattle country, but going out to Hatch, going out to New Mexico and learning about, you know, the growing seasons, about the varietals, about, you know, the obstacles that farmers face when trying to produce a crop. And also, you know, that's a very, you know, obviously a specialty crop. But chili pepper broadened my horizon because, you know, some people are into jalapenos. Some people are into, you know, long greens or Anaheims. Some people are serranos, habaneros. And mm-hmm. I began to learn a lot of the basics and also see the entire food chain from, you know, from planting all the way to on the table at the Coyote Cafe in Santa Fe, and how these really talented chefs were interpreting cuisine based on these foodstuffs. And so from there, I ended up becoming the editor-in-chief of Cowboys and Indians magazine, which was a natural segue given my background, given my experience, and given my exposure to the culinary world. And I ultimately decided to, my publishing partner, Eddie Ryder, and I decided to launch the Land Report. He had hired me to be the executive editor at Chili Pepper. And he and I decided that land was being poorly reported. It was being, as an asset class, you think about this, 80% of us, 80% of Americans live on 3% of the United States. So with that in mind, of course, you know, the focus is going to be residential property. And then probably a distant second would be commercial property. And then occasionally you hear about industrial property. But few people who live in urban America really, for much of the, certainly the 20th century, thought much about where their food was coming from. And we launched a predecessor to the Land Report in 2005, 2006. And then we launched the Land Report itself with the Land Report 100, our signature survey, a look at the nation's leading landowners in 2007. And it's been a great go since then, Paul. Land is an asset class, as you know, has become much more popular.
Yep.
Certainly, it's become it's not quite yet on the standard menu of investment opportunities. You still see, and I still get Fortune and Forbes, and I look at these publications that concentrate on these unicorns, companies that come out of nowhere, get these multi-billion-dollar valuations, become the high flyers for 45 minutes to half an hour, and then implode,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, flame out.
You know, and flame out. Meanwhile, you know, one of the things that I've enjoyed telling people is, you know, looking at land values here in Texas, where I'm from. I mean, in 71, you could buy, the average acre was, you know, $200 for just land out in the country. Now it's over $4,600, and it's just been a slow, steady climb. It has to do with the value of what that land can produce, but it also has to do with the fact that America, Texas in particular, has been growing very robustly, and so you see a lot of transitional land. So we've had a great opportunity to tell this story, to highlight these landowners, and to look at the many different ways that people are drawn to a piece of property. And because of that, I think it gives us an enormous amount of variety and a great readership base.
And, you know, of this top 100, you know, probably the top five are very, well, I take that back. of the top five landowners in the US, some of them are, I'm going to say, are very well known. But you know, the ones especially that invest in forest land are maybe not so well known. So maybe of that top five or 10, for the listeners out there, who are some of the really well-known names and who are some of the maybe not so well-known names?
You know, right off, everybody off the top of their head has got to know King Ranch. You know, it's the birthplace of American ranching, founded by Captain King in 1853. Over 900,000 acres of land, primarily in South Texas, where the home ranch is. But, you know, they are a marketing machine. King Ranch Ford pickup trucks are, you can find them. I see them everywhere, coast to coast. And it's really it's a wonderful success story when it comes to looking at a legacy operation. Several of them are people that you should know, but may not know specifically. One of my favorites, of course, is the Buck family. Peter Buck underwrote and partnered with a young guy who wanted to open up a sandwich shop. Yeah. And Peter Buck was, believe it or not, a nuclear physicist. And he put $1,000 into a venture with Fred DeLuca. And we now know it as the largest franchise operation in the world, Subway Sandwiches.
Yep.
And I just love the idea of turning Subway Sandwiches into pine trees because he has accumulated. Mr. Buck passed away 3 years ago, but his heirs own over 1.2 million acres of timberland in Maine. And it's been just a phenomenal investment that's just very well managed. Many people know the Los Angeles Rams. Certainly Stan Kroenke, the owner of the Rams, the owner of the Colorado Avalanche, Denver Nuggets, very well known in that regard. And he is he runs a very large, his team runs a very large cattle operations in many states out of their Denver headquarters. But as you mentioned accurately, timberland is the largest component of, and I bring this out, Paul, you look at a great piece of timberland, might run 5,000-6,000 an acre, poorer quality might be 3,000 or 2,000 an acre or even less. And as you know, good farmland is getting 20,000 and 30,000 an acre. Yep. And some of the vineyards in, you know, high profile locales can run hundreds of thousands an acre, right?
Yep.
The Emerson family in California, it's one of my favorite stories we've ever done at landreport.com. I'd invite listeners to go to landreport.com and look up Red Emerson. Red got kicked out of high school in 1948 and left with all of his possessions in a single cardboard box. And he went to work on a ranch in Northern Washington, up by the Canadian border. And the following year, he got his high school degree and joined his father in a milling operation down in California. That was 1949. Here we are in 2024. Red, his sons, their family, his daughter, they own over 2.4 million acres. Yep. Of timberland in California, Oregon, and Washington. They're a vertically integrated company that, in fact, I was just out in California with Red looking at one of his, a nursery that he's putting in that will, by next year, will be producing 12 million trees to be planted every year. That's the kind of the seedlings, that's the number of seedlings that they'll be producing. Another well-known owner would be John Malone. John is known as the chairman of Liberty Media out of Denver, not far from your headquarters.
Yep.
And his single largest purchase was again timberland. But that was in Maine in 2011. I like that story because when John did that, when he purchased that timberland, he's the second largest owner of property in the nation. he surpassed the third largest owner, who was Ted Turner. Mm-hmm. And Ted is a very good friend of John's. They're colleagues in the media industry, in the cable industry, and have worked side by side, been on each other's boards. And John blames Ted for giving him the land bug. Ted, as we all know, has purchased, you know, all that bison ground. He's Nebraska's largest landowner. He's New Mexico's largest landowner. And he took John up on a flight. I believe it was on his Flying D ranch in Montana. And by the time that helicopter touched down, John had the bug and began buying property. And of course, we're talking about on a scale of millions of acres. So yeah. It's really interesting to see what motivates, what drives people. And as Ted told me himself, if he had only put all of his money in land, he'd be far better off, because it's this asset class that has slowly, steadily appreciated. And he's made some spectacular buys. And by that, I mean the Flying D in Montana, Vermejo in New Mexico, Avalon in Florida. These are just stunning properties. And he bought many of them long before the drive to own a trophy piece of property took hold.
Yeah. 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 Because he's been buying for what, 30, 40 years, something like that?
Yes. Mid 80s. Yeah. You know, when he took over and launched WTBS and Turner Network TV, TNT, and CNN in the early 80s. That's when he started to, but he kept buying. And occasionally he does some housekeeping, as far as his team does housekeeping, as far as some of the tracks that are available next to existing properties and things like that.
Well, and then I know many of our listeners out there are fans of the Yellowstone series. And I think, didn't Taylor Sheridan, who writes, produces, is the director of those shows, didn't he end up buying a pretty good sized ranch a few years back?
He sure did. That's a great call. Taylor bought the 4/6, which he's featured in several of his series. And please, I would encourage anyone to just go read the story about Taylor on our website, landreport.com. He was kind enough to have us out to a branding on the 4/6 on his Dixon Creek division. And he was actually working with Ann Marion, who was the former owner of the 6s. To do some filming out there and to do some filming on the ranch. And when unfortunately she passed away, and as fate would have it, within about a year, he had the property under contract and has acquired it. And I've caught up with him on numerous occasions, he still has Joe Leathers, who has been the general manager there for quite some time under Ms. Marion. Is still his general manager over all of the ranches. And he's just making it better. He's not trying to tinker with a winning formula. He's trying to enhance it.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And he's pretty prolific on doing series, I can tell you that. What is he up to?
Oh, definitely.
Seven or eight shows now, something like that.
Don't know how he does it. He is just, he just produces great arresting series. Great. I just enjoy all of the different programs that he throws out, from his traditional Yellowstone to Tulsa Kings. He's on it.
So I got to ask you, on the Yellowstone series, who's your favorite character?
You know, I like it when Beth opens a can of whoop ass. I mean, she does it when you least expect it. And yeah. And I think that is, to me, you know, right when you get comfortable, right when you're, you know, maybe getting a little lazy, she just throws that quick left and catches you completely off guard.
I'm sort of Rip is 1A and Beth is 1B for me. So you know,
they're a good tandem.
Although if somebody tells me they're taking me to the train station, that's got a different connotation now. So
yeah, that's, you just have to tell them you're not into mass transit. I'm gonna hitch. Thank you very much.
Exactly. Hey, Eric, we'll take a quick break for a sponsor message, and we'll come back and continue to have some discussion on the land report.
How many years away is the long run for a farmer? 5 years? 10 years? Top producers like Hans Reinschi, a blue diming farming company in Jessup, Iowa, know Raboagri Finance shares his enduring vision for the future.
Whether it's building our grain site or if it's purchasing the next field, we're able to turn to Rabo as a trusted partner to help us get financing to make those generational decisions.
With unmatched financial capacity, local relationship managers, and a global network of sector experts to offer market guidance, Raboagri Finance provides enterprising farmers with a personalized approach to lending and financial services. Growing a better world together, Raboagri Finance.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Top Producer Podcast. I'm Paul Neifer, your host, and we're going to rejoin the conversation with Eric O'Keefe from the Land Report. So, and we'll have some more discussion on maybe some of the more unique owners of farmland. But one question I wanted to ask you, Eric, and I sort of have my opinion, but why do these larger, wealthier people out there really want to buy land? And you've touched on it a little bit, but just what's your thoughts and what's some of the key reasons why they like to buy land, whether it's forest land or farmland?
You know, I think overall, one consideration to keep in mind is that if you're in it for the long game, you're not going to be disappointed. We don't emphasize speculation. We're not buy and flip. We don't chase hot markets. We look at people who have a longer term perspective. Sometimes it's their passion. Sometimes it's in their blood. With many of the people whom we profile, it's a great hedge against what else they might have asset-wise, certainly against inflation. That's, as you know, very counter-cyclical and enjoys steady appreciation. I think, you know, one of my favorite in the current issue, our winter issue, was a number 59 on our Land Report 100 is a fellow named Gene Taylor, who grew up, his father was a logger in southern Alabama, and he grew up going out to timber tracks with him. And today, Gene owns about 230,000 acres of timberland. And he's very humble about it. He says, you know, not bad for a country boy. But he says something which I think is, you have to keep in mind when you look at land versus other assets. And I'm talking about equity. I'm talking about debt or partnerships or a commercial structure. You know, Gene told me, if you have a tract of land, you can ride out to it on a Saturday afternoon and get some real good therapy. Nobody's calling you on the phone. You get to see the deer and the turkeys and all the trees. It's just nice to have a little peace and quiet going through the woods. And I think that's a real interesting extra benefit that comes with a piece of property, whether it be a timber tract, whether it be walking down, walking through a field, in a pasture, along a creek. That's something that's hard to put on a balance sheet. And yet in this day and age, when we get so out of touch with, you know, really who we are and what we're doing, because I think we're just migrating online. You know, so much of what people do these days is not tangible. It's just digital. I think a piece of property is the great antidote to that.
Well, certainly I know with, because I have land in three states, and I call it combine therapy. I get to go out there at harvest time and either I ride the combine, or half the time they say, Paul, here, operate the combine for, you know, 6 hours or a couple of days. And I just call that therapy. That's the best therapy I can ever get.
Amen.
Now, in that latest issue, you also had an article on a person that I think many people will know who they are, but it's sort of near and dear to my heart because I grew up in the Walla Walla area, and that's Drew Bledsoe. For the listeners out there, explain his story.
Drew's story, again, it's available at landreport.com. Drew invited me out. I met him on in front of a restaurant in Walla Walla, out in front of T-Mex.
Yep.
And he said, well, come on out to the winery one of these days, and I'll give you a tour. Drew, as most people know, was the first draft choice in the 93 draft. He grew up like you in Walla Walla. He was a Walla Walla Blue Devil, went and played ball for Washington State, was really the catalyst that turned around the New England Patriots under Robert Kraft and brought them up to Super Bowl quality, took a nasty hit, ended up in the hospital, and some guy named Tom Brady stepped in to replace him.
Yep.
And as Drew likes to say, Tom was very poorly mannered, never gave him his job back, and went on to win a few Super Bowls after that. But Drew had a substantial career afterwards. And one of the things that I really enjoyed in learning Drew's story is that as he was growing up, so was the wine industry in Walla Walla. In the late 70s, early 80s, there were literally a handful, maybe five commercial producers in the Walla Walla Valley. The Walla Walla AVA was designated in 1983 when Drew was in the sixth grade. By the time he left Walla Walla for Washington State, he said, you knew there were wineries out there, but they didn't have much of a presence. By the time he came back, by the time he retired from the pros after a phenomenal 14-year career, he decided that the wine business was going to be his second career. He and his teammates on the Patriots would have dinners together, and they'd all bring, he said they were very competitive, they'd all bring a bottle of wine, and they'd try to outdo each other with their bottles of wine. And he would always, he and Maura would always bring wine from Walla Walla. And they would score extremely well in the blind tastings that he had with his fellow teammates. And so he decided to go into the wine industry himself, go back to his hometown, which is why he labels his winery Double Back. He said Double Back does not refer to fullback, halfback, quarterback. Double Back refers to him going back to where he's from. And he has created an amazing business. He has over 60 employees. He has three different wine brands, and they're producing 18,000 cases a year. But I think what your listeners will get a real insight from is the fact that he said, you know, that country there, as you can well attest, I mean, that's some of the most fertile ground in the United States, and great dry land wheat, yep. Peas, canola, all kinds of good crop ground. And he's buying that. He says, you know, you can get good farmland there for $30,000 an acre. You can put another 30 to 45 in to put in the vines, put in the irrigation. And then obviously you have to tie up your property for two or three, for 3 years until you get a crop, right?
Yep.
And so you have 3 years in, 75,000 before you get your first grape, let alone your first ton of grapes. And he said, compare that to Napa. He said, if you can find grape ground for sale in Napa, you're going to pay well over $500,000 an acre, if not closer to $1 million. And he said, you know, the way he sees it, to be in there at anywhere from 7.5% to 15% of the same capital cost as someone operating in Napa. He's in his hometown. He really likes, and I'd encourage you to tell our listeners a little bit about just Walla Walla itself.
Yeah, Walla Walla is certainly, it was early settled in Washington State in the 1830s and 40s. Like I say, as far as wheat yields in the country, you can have wheat yields in the 170 to 180 bushel range, and that's on dry land, not irrigated. A couple of years ago, that was very, very common. It's just, and if you go out there like in May or June, it's some of the most beautiful country in the world because you got the Blue Mountains as your background, the foothills of the Blue Mountains. You have the green shades from winter wheat and spring wheat and peas and garbs and canola. You know, canola is blooming. It's some of the prettiest crops around. So it is some of the, you know, it's sort of a hidden gem, although it's not as hidden now with your article on Drew.
I think that, you know, one of the things that's going to benefit Walla Walla is it is a little tough to get to.
I
still love that section of Washington, as you mentioned, and thank you for mentioning. You know, I don't think there's, if people ever saw the colors in the Palouse at the right time of year, it almost looks like it's spray painted. The blue sky, the yellows, the greens, the tawny colors, it's just magical.
Plus, for those flatlanders that are listening, you'll come out to that area and I can get you on a nice 45% slope and maybe slide a combine down a hill for you. So, that is something unique about that part of the country. Now, I know there's parts of Europe and other places that have slopes similar to that. But as far as in the U.S., it's definitely the wildest farming ground that you want to see, seeing some. And matter of fact, I'll tell people on the call here, the farm I grew up on, which is just east of Walla Walla and Dixie, the 150-acre field that we had 450 feet of elevation change, which sounds dramatic, but we had a 40-acre field on the backside of that hill that had a 300 feet of elevation change, and we farmed it. So it is a little different than the Midwest.
What did you guys grow there?
We grew wheat, green peas, dry peas. We did barley. Now my cousins, because they farm out there, the ground that I have is primarily wheat. So you got winter wheat, whether it's soft white, which gives you the best yield generally, hard red, spring hard red or winter hard red, and then dry peas. But, definitely canola is a crop out there. Garbs, chickpeas, hummus, and then green peas and dry peas is growing out there.
I was surprised to learn that right outside of Dixie, I believe, was the Jolly Green Giant cannery.
There's several, yes. So there was one up at Waitsburg. Well, at one point in time, back in the 50s, Milton Freewater, which is just just south of Walla Walla, was called the Green Pea Capital of the World. I think they had four or five canneries down there. Walla Walla had three canneries. Waitsburg had a cannery, Dayton had a cannery, and most of those canneries are pretty well gone as far as in that area. The Smith's Frozen Foods is down in Weston, Oregon, and I'm trying to think that might be the closest cannery as far as to Walla Walla that's left.
You know, shame on both of us for not mentioning Walla Walla sweets.
Yeah, yep, the onions, they're definitely... definitely famous. Now, I guess Valdosta, Georgia, and the Maui onion, those are probably the three most famous sweet onions grown in the U.S. So, and that's, most of those onions are grown on the west side of Walla Walla because that soil out there is conducive to growing onions, whereas most of the wheat and the vineyards would either be south and east of Walla Walla. Well, you still have wheat grown west of Walla Walla, but as far as the really high producing wheat country, it's going to be south and east of Walla Walla.
Got it.
Well, we don't have enough time to go into more stories. And I think what we'll do is we'll have another podcast and we'll go into a few other interesting stories. But I always like to end up with a few, three or four key questions. person. You may have mentioned it already a little bit, but who was your mentor in this process?
You know, I did mention it. As I said, my parents insisted on us having a wide selection of great publications at home growing up. Traveled the world with National Geographic, stayed on top of current events with Time. And so I was literally following great journalists from elementary school, reading stories and learning from them on how to tell a story, the depths of stories and the different forks that you could take off of a main thesis. I recently bought a copy of Time magazine that was printed in 1947. I got it because it had a cover story on King Ranch. But the thing that struck me, Paul, was the depth of the reporting in each section and in every department. You know, there'd be a mention of, and I'll just make it up, Toscanini conducting an opera at La Scala, and it would go back centuries to look at the opera's genesis. It would talk about Toscanini himself. It would talk about the, you know, and you're just amazed, you know, in this day and age where people are, I see our Land Report 100 story copy and pasted all over the place on websites that that don't do any original research.
Yeah.
And, you know, the effort required to do great journalism has always inspired me and also goaded me on.
Good, good. Do you have time for any hobbies?
Probably my favorite is being on the land, Paul, just like you. You know, I love to just get out there. I don't care if it's, just like you said, I don't care if we're looking at grape ground in Walla Walla, looking at a tree nursery in the Shasta Valley of California, or on a sheep farm on Martha's Vineyard, and looking at fences that were built, rock stone fences that were built centuries ago. I just like, that's a combination of see, smell, touch, and history.
Yep. Yeah, no, totally agree. Is there anything that keeps you up at night?
Besides deadlines.
Yeah,
exactly. with as many moving parts, let me put it this way. With our Land Report 100 story in itself, it's not an article, it's a study. And we have so many moving parts. And I'm trying, I'm really committed to making sure that whatever anyone reads is as accurate, as informative, and a good read. And so how do we do it better? You know, that's the challenge.
Exactly. And then what's your definition of success, either in farming or land investing or business or any of those type of operations?
You know, to me, for landowners, the thing that I always, I'm always amazed by and inspired by landowners is their problem-solving ability. You know, someone who's in it for the long haul, who approaches a piece of property may be entirely different. You know, you mentioned your parents, your cousins. You know, you think about how things have changed in 2024 versus 2000 versus 1964. And I'm always amazed at the number of obstacles that can derail a harvest, whether it be Mother Nature or markets or interest rates. And that to me is why I'd like to just take a moment to tip my hat to someone who recently passed, a friend to landowners and farmers in particular, Iowa's former Secretary of Agriculture, Bill Northey, who died suddenly at 64 earlier this month. I had the pleasure, you had the honor as well, of interviewing Bill and getting to see his commitment to the farming community, to agriculture in general. And I had the fortune to interview Bill shortly after he affected probably the greatest pivot in American farming history when he took, during the pandemic, all of the foodstuffs that were going to commercial operations that closed down. Mm-hmm. That would be the airlines that were shuttered. That would be the stadiums. That would be the schools. That would be restaurants. Think about all those millions of tons of foodstuffs that were online to go that way. And he and his team were able to recommit, repackage, direct it to people at home. Do you remember those empty shelves that we were looking at for a few weeks?
Yes, I do. Definitely.
Bill and his team, excuse me, at USDA are the ones who took, you know, all of this bounty that we have, but that is so narrowly targeted and shifted it. It was one of the most amazing achievements, and it's an under-heralded achievement. Yeah. And I just want to remind people of, you know, the good souls out there who are working their tails off for us at USDA, people like Bill, who grew up in the farming community and have done us all proud.
Totally agree. So again, Eric, we could easily make this a 2 or 3 hour podcast. Today we'll keep it to about 45 minutes, but I will definitely reach out to you sometime in the future, and we'll do another podcast.
Hey, when things get thin and you need to hear the same stories again and again, I'm your guy.
I'm not too worried about that, Eric. So, again, this is the Top Producer Podcast. This is Paul Neefe, your host, signing off.